when Grace met in our living room, we didn't need this. 1981, Mark. My name's Steve Kennedy. I've heard a number of people last few weeks saying, who is that guy? When they're referring to the speaker that we've had, and this week I just thought I had to say that. Steve Kennedy, I teach international and comparative human rights law at Trinity Law School. I know. Don't worry, this morning I figured out how to turn off my cell phone. I'm not sure I could do it again. A few years back, my friend Joe Piccioni was offered a position as a medical ethicist for a small hospital chain in the Midwest. When he was first offered the job, he said to me, I'm not sure I'm ready for it. His age, education, work experience weren't at issue at all. I said, what do you mean? He said, I know I'm technically qualified for the job. I just wonder if I'm mature enough to do it with integrity. Who asked that question? I don't. Not pro athletes. Not celebrities, entertainers, and pop singers. Not corporate executives who work at Pfizer. Not politicians seeking election to public office. Not most pastors when they pray for church growth. Everyone wants the added responsibility, the promotion, the raise, the new contract, but few ask if they have the character to handle it. Challenges, added responsibilities, and success are good. But we should remember that most lottery winners are case studies in lives that serve only as a warning to others. In our culture, we're awash with weak, immature, and corrupt character. Educational and financial rewards go to people who master technical skills, but not the skills for life. We assume that mastering technical skills automatically produces mature character. We say athletics promotes good character. Studying hard promotes mature character. It builds it. Well, sometimes it does, but often it doesn't. The evidence is in people's lives as they daily crash and burn around us, whether they're successful or not. And even if they don't crash and burn, a lot of times they make other people crash and burn, sometimes millions of them. Immature character isn't a new problem. The great elder of Jerusalem, the brother of Jesus Christ himself, James, is also concerned about it. And we're going to look this morning at his letter. He challenges his readers to ask clearly, as we might say, are you for real? It's not a philosophical question, but a practical one. He starts this way. Consider it all joy, my brethren, when you encounter various temptations, knowing that the testing of your faith produces steadfastness. And let steadfastness have its maturing to perfection result, so that you may be mature and complete, lacking nothing. But if any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask of God, who gives to all generously and without reproach, and it will be given to him. Passages like this remind us that life's serious business, and we'd better pay attention if we're going to navigate it successfully. A lot of times you kind of have the feeling this maybe is a dress rehearsal. Next time you're going to be able to get it right. It's not going to happen. Real life brings various temptations, all right. As one man says, multicolored, complex, and intricate forms of temptation. And in response, we often construct various multicolored, complex, and intricate forms of self-deception in order to cope with it and deny that we're having to deal with temptations, and that we so often fail them. We're so inattentive that half the time we don't even know we're being tempted until we've already failed the test. It's already gone by. We go, heavens, I've just been tempted. I wish I'd seen that coming. I wish I'd said something else. I wish I hadn't done it that way. Now, joy is the appropriate byproduct of passing the tests of temptation. By resisting temptations, our faith increases and we cultivate steadfastness. Then steadfastness produces mature character. And mature character is the end or goal or purpose of our life. Anticipating that most of us recognize our lack of maturity, in verse 5, James moves straight on from consider it all joy and the business of growing to mature character to saying, I know how you're going to feel, so let's talk about wisdom. Asking God for wisdom doesn't mean that it spontaneously appears in us as if by some sort of immaculate conception. We see already that mature character requires a good bit of effort by resisting temptations. So I conclude that God gives us wisdom, and he teaches us that in watchful experience of resisting temptations, we become steadfast. By becoming steadfast, in order to become steadfast, we have to be able to make wise decisions when we face temptations. So what's wisdom? The main chapter I want to talk about today is James chapter 3, verses 13 to 18. Who among you is wise and understanding? Let him show by his lovely behavior his deeds and the gentleness of wisdom. But if you have bitter jealousy and selfish ambition in your heart, do not be arrogant and so lie against the truth. This wisdom is not that which comes down from above, but is earthly, unspiritual, devilish. For where jealousy and selfish ambition exist, there is disorder and every evil thing. But the wisdom from above is first pure, then peaceable, meek, reasonable, full of mercy and good fruits, unwavering, without hypocrisy. And the seed whose fruit is righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace. I know how Bill Beck feels up here. We're designed to be wise. The ability to be wise is planted in us. It's part of the image of God that we bear. It isn't reserved for only a few mystically gifted people. Wisdom is what we're made to be. Wisdom's a virtue, a skill, a habit into which we should grow. A certain young quarterback who will remain unnamed, who's had a very successful weekend, has learned a lot by studying films of opposing teams and of his own play. But where he's really honed his skill is in playing on the field. Wisdom is like that. It's learning to act wisely in the real world, and by so acting, that's how we become wise. It isn't abstract knowledge. It's the skill that directs action to be good. We don't invent it. It's the clear-sighted ability to see the world as it is and to see what things are worth as God made them and to act and treat them appropriately. Instead of pretending that they invent a world where they're at the center of everything, wise people participate in God's world as he made it. Sometimes it helps to understand something by looking at its opposite. Every virtue has an opposite. Love, for example, used to sit in your dorm rooms and argue, what's the opposite of love? Is it indifference or is it hatred? It's both. On one side, you have the lack of the virtue. On the other side, a corrupted, ruined cultivation that only mocks the real virtue, as does hatred with love. In wisdom, the lack of wisdom is the one we're familiar with from reading the book of Proverbs, mostly. It talks about the fool. The fool lacks wisdom, and everything he does is folly. On the other hand, though, there is a misshapen, corrupted version of wisdom. That's also in the book of Proverbs. And it's cunning. I call it bogus wisdom. Remember the 60s? Anyway. Real wisdom makes our behavior lovely and gentle. But if our action isn't lovely, then bitter jealousy and self-ambition are the things that inhibit and corrupt our growth to maturity in Christ. Bogus wisdom is at the heart of immature and corrupt character. Character isn't personality or temperament or being cool or nerdy. Character is shaped by the virtues and vices that are resident in us at any given time. The virtues of love and wisdom, justice and courage, mercy, beneficence, generosity, etc., faith and hope. Character is who we really are when nobody's looking. We have to face what we see in ourselves when we look inside and not deny the vices and lie to ourselves and others about what we're really like. That's why what James means when he talks about lying against the truth and lying to others about who we really are. But he writes, but if you have bitter jealousy and selfish ambition in your heart, don't be arrogant and so lie against the truth. This wisdom isn't that which comes down from above, but is earthly, natural, or unspiritual, and devilish. And as I read that, I thought, who thinks that bitter jealousy and selfish ambition are signs of wisdom? Unfortunately, the words are so familiar that they hide, I think, what's involved. Cunning people have a way of making bitter jealousy and self-ambition invisible to us. How? Well, first, cunning people make jealousy and self-ambition look virtuous by conning us into thinking that only suffering tries and proves our character, not success, good health, luxury, wealth, power. But as Proverbs 30 informs us, two things I ask of you. Do not refuse me before I die. Keep dissension and lies far from me. Give me neither poverty nor riches. Feed me with the food that is my portion, that I may not be full and deny you and say, who is the Lord? Or that I not be in want and steal and profane the name of my God. Second, cunning people hide their character, at least for a time, from people who aren't wise. How? Well, the main mask that we wear these days is to be cool. Cool is the mask we use to hide our vulnerability, our dependence on others, our mortality. Cool looks competent, in control, no fears, no anxieties. We have it all together, as we used to say. Now, Dave Gundlach often says that we operate out of one of two emotional bases, fear or anger. I think we're all afraid, and we respond to that fear with anger or what I'll call dread. We're all afraid because, as I said, we live in a threatening and insecure world where we're vulnerable, dependent, and mortal. And we need security and safety. There is an appropriate emotional response in such circumstances, but whether it goes to anger or dread is the problem. Interestingly, the beginning of wisdom in the scriptures is the fear of the Lord. Jesus says, don't fear the one who can kill your body, fear the one who can condemn your soul. If we fear God, we needn't fear other people or our circumstances. But most of us fear other things more than God, so we mask our vulnerability and our dependence and feel anger or dread when the masks slip or fall off completely. Our mask for cunning in this culture is to be cool. Even I want to be cool like John Hackey. No socks. Third, cunning people pretend that our desires are simply a matter of seeing something and wanting it. And I think in this particular ruse, there's some sort of devilish influence, devilish forces at work. We're basically imitative beings. Human beings imitate. Somewhere over here, I think, is my granddaughter. If you want to know about how we imitate, watch a little one. She's 18 months. She wants to imitate everything. She wants to feed the dog just like grandma does, or her mom. She wants to do absolutely everything that we do. She's sure cute. We're made to be like God and to imitate Him, including His desires. But in a fallen world, our desires are shaped by wanting to be like other people and to have what other people have, to be like them. For all our vaunted autonomy, our desires aren't aroused by things we choose consciously. Usually they're chosen. Usually we desire things because other people have them and we want to be like them. That's why jealousy figures so prominently in the scriptures. I'm not sure we think about it often enough. We say, oh, well, I really don't want what they want. I just want one like it. At least that's what I do. I don't know about you. But what I'm discovering more and more is that actually my desires aren't really mine. They're aroused by the things that I want in the people I want to be like. They are mediated, in a sense, through other people. That's why sex sells. Images sell. Because that's what people want to be like. On the other hand, people with real wisdom see what things really are. They desire things that God desires, the way God desires them. They desire things according to the value that God gives them. They understand that some things are worthy of a lot of love, some things aren't. There's an order of love, St. Augustine said. Do we love things appropriately? Wise people resist the desires of people who defy God's desires, which are the source of bitter jealousy and selfish ambition. Indeed, bitter jealousy and self-ambition move us to use people as a means for our own end. And that's what the cunning person is really adept at, manipulating others to get what he or she wants for him or herself. Don't let your stereotypes limit your thinking about jealousy and ambition. It's not just limited to aggressive self-promoters who always want to corner the conversation, who always want to bring it back around to themselves. That's not the person we think is wise. More subtle is the cunning manipulator who seems to know what's real and may even be self-effacing, but his every thought and action is to get what he wants out of others instead of to listen in openness to know who others are and what they need and what we owe to each other. The unworthiness of his goal and the means he uses are what makes him dangerous and corrupt. Now that we've analyzed vices associated with bogus wisdom, we can perhaps come back to what James says about authentic or real wisdom, being real, and enjoy the bracing freshness of what that's like. Now, wise people know what things really are because they see the way real people should see. They see in things what they're really worth. Seems like an odd way to put it. But the way that I frequently have to think about this is simply the fact I'm on a 35-year, so far, study of one particular woman to whom I'm now married. And in that study, it seems to me what wisdom is teaching is to back off and be quiet and let her be who she is and try to figure that out. Now, she told me that the reason we have three daughters is so that I could do that. And it's, you know, we're still working on it. But a wise man knows who his wife really is, does everything he can to remove all the expectations that and projections and the projections of desires and all the other things that confuse the picture so that he can't ever really hear who she is. In the phrase wise and understanding in verse 13, the word understanding, often paired with that word wise, simply means to be skilled at using wisdom, at acting wisely. How do we know if someone is skillful in wisdom? Well, James says, it's made known by how well the person lives. Are they known by lovely, noble behavior? Deeds done in the gentleness of wisdom, or not? And what in the world does that mean? Well, in the New Testament, there are two words for good. We have one, they have two. One means simply the moral quality, doing something good instead of doing something evil. The other one talks about the beauty of the good. The phrase that we often see in Scripture, the beauty of holiness. The word here emphasizes the beauty of good action. It's the same word we find when God creates the world in Genesis 1 and 2 and says every time he finishes at the end of the day, it's good. It's good. By that he means it's morally good. In other words, it's good that it exists instead of not exist and that it has a moral nature, and it means that it's beautiful. Wise people's behavior is lovely and noble by habit. Wisdom is the habit of their heart. It doesn't spring sporadically and spontaneously out of nowhere, but it's carefully and lovingly cultivated, like Tina Drake's garden. Wisdom is brought to maturity by resisting temptations, by working to eliminate bitterness and self-absorption, learning to see things as they really are and to treat others with the dignity that they deserve. Not by putting on masks and pretending that we're cool. To go back to the passage, but the wisdom from above is first pure, then peaceable, meek, reasonable, etc. Wise people are pure. That's why they get to see God. From Matthew 5, verse 8, blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. They don't try to manipulate others, especially not God, in order to get what they want out of them. That's how they can see things and see in things what they really are. To be pure in heart is to be single-eyed. That is, to have intentions only for the good of others so that we can see who they really are. But the word purity is often sort of, well, I think we make it really religious, kind of out there, mystical. I had the experience a couple of weeks ago of having to drive up into an older part of Orange County, or getting to drive up into an older part of Orange County. But I had this experience of going into a shopping center that I can only say was disorienting and chaotic. They had these signs. I have to preface all of this by the fact that I've been watching a wonderful documentary on the font Helvetica, okay? I know. We do that kind of thing sometimes. And so I'm much more aware of my surroundings than I used to be. And we drove into this place. A colleague had recommended the House of Chicken Pies. I should have known. But we got there, and it was everything you can imagine, nothing but ceramic old chickens of all kinds and roosters everywhere and pot pies and, you know, mashed potato buds and gravy that was like, but anyway, nobody wanted to say anything because a colleague had recommended this place to us. And nobody wanted to say, well, this is the worst dinner I've had in like 20 years. It was like a nightmare out of the 50s. And you come outside and there are all these signs, and there's the top one is this kind of goofy wedding font, handwriting, you know, House of Chicken Pies. And then under it would be another font, maybe these goofy serifs all over them, you know, dun, 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 dun. And then at the bottom, another one. It says, takeout. And you look around the whole place, and all the signs were like this. And you have this sense of this place that's just chaos, and you feel, at least I felt, really uncomfortable. We get in the car and we leave after this miserable meal. We're driving up this street, and I look over, and here's this plain, simple building. And on it, it says, Target. Target. It's Helvetica. And I can't tell you how much better I felt. And I kept talking about it, and one of my colleagues said, why are you talking about this? Well, I couldn't say, because I don't want to talk about how crummy the restaurant was. I mean, that was unsettling too. But it was an amazing thing. This pure, simple, wonderful little sign, Target, on a building, relieved me. All the whatever that was going on inside, whoosh, gone. It was pure and simple. Don't let purity become, don't let any of these words just be religious language. I think too often we live in what I like to call Bible land. In Bible land, everything makes sense. In Bible land, we have words like purity, peaceable, gentleness, meekness. In the real world, everything like that's irrelevant. We don't want any of that, none of that here. It doesn't fit, it doesn't work. Nonsense. Wise people are peaceable. Why soldiers are peaceable? Because they know the horror of violence. People say, you teach the Geneva Conventions? What do you mean there's a law of war? War is just hell. Well, yeah, it is. But I'll tell you, who really wants to know about the Geneva Conventions? Soldiers, particularly officers. Why? Because it protects their men and their women. They want order. They don't want chaos. And contrary to what a lot of the world thinks, the United States military services are probably the most well-educated and most observing of the Geneva Conventions. Wise soldiers are peaceable. They know the horrors of violence. Bitter jealousy and selfish ambition cause people to enjoy dissension. Peaceable people love peace, seek at every turn to make peace, find ways to reconcile disputes. That's what we do at a law school. Lawyers are supposed to resolve disputes. First thing we know about Solomon's wisdom is what? He resolves a dispute. Two women come in, my baby. He figures out a creative way to determine which one belongs, you know, who this baby belongs to. Very quickly, they're all amazed. He resolved the dispute. He saw right through it. That's what wisdom does. It sees through disputes. It knows how to resolve things. Help people to be at peace with each other. The purity of peaceful people gives them insight into the true nature of a dispute. This is what God does with us. It took the death of his own son to bring peace with God. That's the most creative resolution you can imagine in all of the universe. Wise people are meek or gentle or humble. Really, that means they yield. Wise people don't yield because they're weak in character, because they're afraid of people. Wise people are meek because they respect people. And they also are very aware of their own limitations, their own disposition towards self-deception. Humble people know that everyone is a spiritual, rational, creative, moral, personal being. Everyone you ever meet is a spiritual, rational, creative, moral, personal being. No one's a two-thirds person. Everyone's held morally responsible for what they do. Everyone. And everyone who is responsible for what they do is a human. Our animals aren't. Your pets walk around naked in the house all the time. Even in front of the company. We don't run around trying to put pants on them. Lions eat maybe other lions. Chimps kill other chimps and eat them. They're not morally blameworthy. My mother confused the heck out of our cat. She'd go out and praise it to high heaven for killing gophers and moles and then whack on it with a newspaper for killing birds. Like it knows. It's not a moral being. A woman who's known to some of you was once overheard by her husband watching the crows and the seagulls go at it on the beach. She said, phew, watching them go, they're basically having a gang war out there. She says, well, you've obviously never heard the Sermon on the Mount. He thought, huh? They're not moral beings. Human beings are, though. And that's what we're to respect in them. The fact that they're moral, that they're spiritual. Every person we ever meet could be in heaven. You could have to spend eternity with them. Humble people practice seeing others this way. How do we know this in real life? Where do we not yield? When we drive. I'm trying to think about practical examples so that we don't get into Bible land here. It used to be that when you pulled up to a stop sign, somebody might smile at you. If you got there first and you were on the right, they went like that. Or they just sat there and waited. They yielded. There's a philosophy of getting on and off the freeway. The right lanes are made for getting on and getting off. You're not supposed to go 90 there. You're supposed to yield. You yield the right of way so that people can get on safely and get off safely. You can go as fast as you want over here, but not over here. This is the safe place where you get to come on and come off. And that's where we yield. Humble people are people who know when to yield. The word reasonable here also includes some kind of yielding. Wise people aren't gullible, but they do listen to other people's arguments with the idea, you know, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I don't have every answer to everything on the planet. Reason's a habit of thought and observation. It's modest in its certainties. It recognizes ambiguities in life. And it says, you know, sometimes I can actually change my mind. I might be wrong. Now, they may argue about the truth, but in that argument, they're open to being persuaded. Thus, they're full of mercy because they listen carefully. They know their own foibles, so they know other people's foibles. Their own vulnerability and dependence, so they know that of others. And we who have been shown the most mercy of all people on earth ought to show the most mercy of all. Wise people don't... Hi! Isn't that a nice little voice? Wise people don't waver in their purpose to know and live in the real world. They're unwavering. They know there's no neutral. We're always either growing toward maturity or backwards away from it. Good gardeners know that there's no neutrality in the garden. It's either flourishing or it's moving toward chaos. Plants are vulnerable to diseases, pests, heat, cold, people, dogs, insects. A good gardener knows that. Doesn't leave it to itself for very long. It's the same with our soul. To be unwavering is to be constantly cultivating, bringing nutrition, everything that's needed for the soul to grow. Gardeners don't waver in their commitment if they're going to have good fruits. The same is true for people who are keepers of their souls. Wise people don't try to maintain two faces, which is hypocrisy. They don't have a face for the world that masks who they really are and a face that only they know. Wise people aren't consumed by trying to be cool and thus to hide their vulnerability. So, if that's the case, how do we become wise? Well, there are no techniques for becoming wise. Sorry, no 10, 12, 15, 18, or 20 steps. are ever going to get you there, or three or two. But the Bible doesn't leave us adrift. We find lots of analogies there, first of all, that help us to think rightly about wisdom. Things like this: to commit villainy is like the pleasure of laughter to a fool. But wisdom is like the pleasure of laughter to an understanding person. Good runners and good swimmers like to run and swim. Skilled musicians delight in playing their instruments. Skilled financial wizards, I don't know, they're good at, and they like what they do. I don't know what that is. Some of them are good. Great scholars love to study. Wise people find pleasure and great delight in being skilled at wisdom. And you can be skilled at wisdom and skilled in all kinds of other things as well. Fools and the cunning find pleasure and delight in wrongfully using others for their own selfish purposes. They love to pull one over on somebody. We know how wise we are or aren't by judging what we find pleasurable and delightful. We find ourselves laughing at what's, if we find ourselves laughing at what's demeaning and small-minded or coarse and hurtful, we know we're in trouble. If we find pleasure in violence and gore and mayhem, it's probably a good sign that folly and cunning lurk somewhere nearby. Not only do we have ways to think rightly about wisdom, wisdom is cultivated by doing wise things, not just thinking about it. There are certain actions also that we find in Scripture. First, I was glad to hear that you're going to be looking at a book by Dallas Willard in one of the women's groups. First, we should practice listening for genuine signs of mature character, not bogus ones. And if you read the first half of chapter 3, you'll find a long and stinging message about the tongue from James. For we all stumble in many ways. If anyone does not stumble in what he says, he's a perfect man, able to bridle the whole body as well. Of course, we all feel this way. Now, if we put the bits into the horse's mouth so that they will only obey us, we direct their entire body as well. Look at the ships also. Though they're so great and are driven by strong winds, are still directed by a very small rudder, wherever the inclination of the pilot desires. So also the tongue is a small part of the body, and yet it boasts of great things. See how great a forest is set aflame by such a small fire. And the tongue is a fire, the very world of iniquity. The tongue is set among our members as that which defiles the entire body and sets on fire the course of our lives, etc. We need to look at the real indicators of character. Second, examine Jesus' own disciplines. For example, he frequently goes away on his own to be silent and alone. Now, verbal communication is a wonderful gift, and we're made to be in personal relationships with each other. That's what it means to be a person, to be able to be face-to-face in a personal relationship with them. It's a good thing. But the problem is that we tend to be unmindful of what we're saying and who we're talking to. The disciplines of silence and solitude take us away to think about what we're saying, to think about who other people are, give us a break so that we can go back and be more careful about what comes out of our mouths and more able to see others as they really are and to know them and love them as they really are. Both practices are helpful in learning to listen to people, especially those with whom we disagree, without reacting in fear and anger, because in the words that are printed in your bulletin from Joseph Pieper, the world reveals itself to the silent listener and only to him. The more silently he listens, the more purely he's able to perceive reality. Since reason is nothing else than the power to understand reality, then all reasonable, sensible, sound, clear, and heart-stirring talk stems from listening silence. Thus, all discourse requires a foundation in the depth of silence. Otherwise, speech is sourceless. It turns into chatter, noise, and deception. Let's pray.